Next case, United States v. Robinson. Appellant ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. May it please the court. I am Major Mark Brueger, and along with my co-counsel, Captain Patricia Encarnacion Miranda, we represent the appellant in this case, Senior Airman Hank Robinson. Chief Judge Stuckey, with your permission, can we reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal?
Indeed.
Thank you. Today, Airman Robinson raises two issues before this court. First, the military judge abused his discretion by failing to suppress evidence from Airman Robinson's phone. This evidence was obtained solely through a custodial interrogation after the request for counsel. Second, the Air Force Court erred when it found that Airman Robinson waived his objections regarding the scope of his consent. Evidence in this case was, in fact, provided presenting that the agents effected the consent through a false assertion which showed that Airman Robinson's consent was, in fact, involuntary, and therefore he preserved that issue regarding the scope of the overall voluntariness of his consent. Turning first to issue one. If an accused in a custodial setting requests counsel, all interrogation must cease until an attorney is present.
Is it your position, counsel, that that the law should be changed, that a request to search now is per se prohibited once someone has invoked the right to counsel?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay, so then how does that work in this case?
Sure. The rationale behind why a request for consent is okay and does not qualify as an interrogation is because it provides a neutral fact. It doesn't say whether or not someone says yes or no to consent shows that as incriminating whatsoever. So, for example, in this case, the fact that Airman Robinson said, yes, I consent to the search of my phone, the government could not have gone in there and said, see, because he said yes, it shows that he's guilty of a crime. That standard still applies. The fact that you can request consent is okay. That doesn't qualify as an interrogation. The problem with this case is all of the questions that went along with it. And there were several in this case. There was, what is the make and model of your phone? What is your phone number? And finally, and this is probably the most egregious, is what is your passcode? All of those questions were not administrative
so
in nature.
I have a request. I request, can I search your house? You know, yes, you can. Well, where is your house? Will you give me the key? Right? How is that different from what happened?
Well, Your Honor, first and foremost, I think
are you suggesting that they can't do that?
Well, if I can take it one step at a time, Your Honor, I think the first part of your question was where is your house? And I think that question was actually settled by this court's predecessor in United States v. Roa, where the majority, in fact, the concurrence with Chief Judge Everett actually talked about how it was probably improper for the government to ask the accused where his locker was located at. What they actually talked about in that case...
That was because knowledge of where the locker was an incriminating fact, right?
That is correct. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So if knowledge of where the house isn't an incriminating fact, that's different, isn't it?
I think in that particular scenario, Your Honor, I think that you're dealing, again, with two different scenarios. I think, first and foremost, if the government does not know where the house is, then yes, I think potentially that is an incriminating fact. That is something that the government is not relying on its own independent labors to discover. They're actually requesting it from an accused after he's requested counsel. And that could lead to incriminating evidence. But the second portion of that, I think, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your question correctly, is if the government has independently verified the location of a house, I think the scenario is slightly different. And I think in that scenario, potentially, if it's just unlocking the door with a key, I think potentially that's okay. I think anything further than that, though, and anything that requires them to use the contents of their mind is, in fact, problematic.
Well, I mean, obviously, I didn't agree with the court in Mitchell, so I'm going to be a hard sell, but it seems to me like you're trying to go even further than Mitchell, and you can say that you're not saying that any request to search is prohibited, but that's actually, in fact, what you're saying.
So, Your Honor, I think what the standard should be, and I think what the standard actually is, according to Edwards, according to Roa, according to Hubble, I think what the standard is that the request for consent to search is still fine. You can ask for request to consent. That's everything else on top of that could be problematic. And again, I would point to Chief Judge Everett's concurrence in ROA that discussed the difference between communications and consent. And he talked about how if there are questions designed to elicit a proprietary interest in property, that's where the trouble lies. That's where the problems come out from. And I think it's interesting in this case, Your Honor, what this court warned about in Mitchell actually occurred here. What this court warned about is that this passcode, this provision of the passcode in Mitchell, those investigators could have absolutely used that evidence to implicitly show ownership. That did occur here. Those questions about make and model of the cell phone, about the phone number, those actually came in as substantive evidence against the accused. In fact, what the agent testified to, there's a portion of the record, it's at JA 130. They asked the question, and whose phone number was this for consent? And it was Airman Robinson's. Where did you get that from? Airman Robinson himself. That's what the agent testified to. And then on top of that, they also included the Air Force Form 1364 as Prosecution Exhibit 3. And that was provided to the jury in this case. And all of the information that was obtained, that was included in that form, was obtained through Airman Robinson's mouth.
Counsel, why don't you tell me how this is supposed to work? The accused has a phone. It's okay to ask him, after he's invoked counsel, it's okay to ask him, can we search your phone, right?
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor.
And the accused wants his phone searched. What happens? I mean, he can't consent?
Your Honor, respectfully, I would disagree with the presupposition that he wants his phone.
Let's change it. What if he does want it? What if I'm sitting there and I know there's nothing on my phone, you can look at it, and he gives them the phone, and they discover they can't get in the phone? What are they supposed to do?
So
the accused can't consent at that point under your theory, at least.
No, Your Honor, I think how it would work, actually, is I think what we're talking about is two different things. I think we're talking about whether or not there's a consent to search, whether or not I'm voluntarily providing something because I want to give it. I think voluntary giving something, and it's like voluntary admissions, I think that's still
okay, fine. That's my question.
And
you're making the point that that's different than this situation.
Absolutely right.
Okay,
yes, Your Honor.
Got you.
I think the practical application of something like this would be simply what Edwards and Hubble and Mitchell and a whole progeny of these cases talk about, which is consent itself, the request, is fine. Anything that goes beyond that and that the investigator should know is reasonably likely to elicit incriminating information, that stuff comes out.
Can I ask you a question based on what Judge Sparks was just talking about? What about a scenario where OSI says, may we search your phone? And the accused says, yes, and my passcode is ABCD. Is that fine?
I think that would be fine, Your Honor, because that's a voluntary admission. And I think that how this court would apply that, or any other appellate court would apply, would be, was there any express questioning or other actions performed by the investigators that they should have known was reasonably likely to elicit that passcode? And I think in the scenario that you just provided, I think it's fine.
So what if they ask for permission to search your house, right? And instead of a regular door, right, they have a key code door, right? And they say, so we don't break down your door, will you give us the key code, right? That's prohibited under your theory, too.
So are we talking about how are we talking about how, has the government already independently verified that this is the home and stuff like that?
They're at the house. Can I search your house? Yes, you can. Right? Okay. Can I have the passcode to your door? I mean, under your theory, they have to break the door down. They can't ask, but they could break the door down, and that's not the law, or it shouldn't be the law.
Well, Your Honor, I think that is absolutely how the case law would come out. And I think the problem with that is on the other side, if you apply it the other way, is that if you require him to give that passcode, you're not just establishing for the government.
Him. You're asking him.
You're asking him a question that could lead to incriminating information. That goes beyond the mere consent to search.
The search of his house.
That goes beyond the mere consent to search, though. That provides incriminating information.
I've ever heard.
Well, but the problem with that is, Your Honor, is that if you actually make him provide that passcode or if you ask the question for that, you're not only establishing a link in the government's chain of evidence, you're providing the government a nail in the defense's coffin. I mean, think about how that would work at actual trial. The government can provide all this evidence saying, I've got the house records, I've got this, and that might be enough to overcome reasonable doubt for a jury that indicates that this is his house.
There's no question that it's his phone. So who cares?
I think the question, Your Honor, would still be, it depends on how they know it's his house.
Because he's at the house and he said, yes, you can search my house. Because he has a phone in his pocket.
Well, Your Honor, so I think therein is where the problem lies here, is because there's a distinct difference between possession and ownership. Possession is circumstantial evidence that this person can operate and control that phone. But asking the question about what is the make and model, what is your phone number, what is your passcode, that is direct evidence that shows that this person not only owns the phone, can control it, has knowledge of how it works, but also the potential exclusivity that is inherent in the passcode-protected phone.
So under your view, what should have happened in this case? They say, he's in boat counsel, they come to him and they say, all right, would you consent to your phone? And they don't say anything else. He doesn't say anything. He just hands in the phone. Is it your theory that at that point they just have to get in the phone however way they need to get into it? They know they can't get in it without him giving them the password. But under your theory, I guess, is that once he says, sure, you can search my phone, you got to get in it whatever way you can figure out how to get into it.
Your Honor, unless he's voluntarily provided, I would say yes, that's correct, and I would point again.
I'm saying without saying anything further, he gives them the phone, mm-hmm. right? And under your theory, I think, without any more said, is that the government or the investigators at that point have to find their own way into the phone. Is that right?
Your Honor, it's not just my theory. It's the theory of Chief Judge Everett from ROA. Okay.
You want to blame it on Chief Judge Everett?
I'm sorry?
You're trying to blame it on Chief Judge Everett?
Your Honor, it makes intuitive sense, though. The issue with that is that there is a distinction between communication and consent. And what Chief Judge Everett said in ROA was, because there are these issues with authentication and identification that are inherent with consent searches, the safest course of action is to go through counsel. And that's what they should have done in this case. And if they did not want to go through counsel, then they could have relied on their own independent labors to get inside the cell phone.
Well, let's drag the current chief judge into this. How does that differ from Mitchell?
Your Honor, I don't think it does. I think that the fact that there was a potential seizure vice of consent, I think it's a distinction without a difference. And I think that from a lot of the questions from this court during Mitchell, I think Judge Sparks actually mentioned this quite a bit, was this a consent? Was it a voluntary search? I don't think it matters. The question is not how they came to get the phone. It's not whether it's a seizure or it's a surrender through a consent search. The real issue are the questions surrounding that, is the interrogation thereafter. And I think that's what Mitchell actually talked about. Mitchell talked about all we need to do to establish an Edwards violation is custody and interrogation. So the way they actually get the phone, it's irrelevant for Edwards' purposes. And so I think it actually lines
back to what I began with, which is under your new theory of the law, you can't really consent to search once you've invoked your right to counsel. You can't truly consent to a search of your phone.
Your Honor, the difference therein, I think, and this is where maybe you and I disagree.
You can search my phone, nanny nanny boo boo, good luck, right?
Yeah.
Make fun of you, but I mean, I don't see how this works.
Well, Your Honor, I think again,
the notion that all these questions are somehow an interrogation just turns the Fifth Amendment on its head.
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't believe that's the case. I think that the consent to search, the request, is still fine. Everything else on top of that is an issue. And I understand your perspective. This might make the government's job a little bit harder, but that's why it's a burden.
I so much care about the government's job. I'm not exactly concerned about the government's
yes,
job.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I was on the other side in Mitchell, and you confused me, too. He always can consent if it's actual consent.
Yes.
If there's no
badgering.
If there's no badgering, torture, you know, what have you in the thing.
Yes, sir.
So let's get off that and figure out where we are here.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, again, I think where we are, and if you look back at Mitchell, I don't think there was really any badgering. I mean, I think there was some argument about whether or not there was badgering was there.
The majority thought that he was badgered. I didn't think he was badgered, but they specifically relied on the fact that he was badgered.
Well,
so you're stuck with that.
Well,
the badgering here?
Well, Your Honor,
we had white bears yesterday, badgers today. sorry. That's bring up the honey badger.
I was told not to mention animals. Yes, Your Honor. No, the issue with Mitchell is that any statement, with the Mitchell, it comes the presumption that any statement given without counsel is involuntary. And that's the issue after this. I think that the whole issue with consent is still fine, but all these other issues, I mean, there's no administrative purpose to ask what the phone number is. There's no administrative purpose to use to talk about what the make and model is. I mean, and that evidence was used directly against my client during his court-martial. I mean, that is the ultimate issue here. So, Your Honor, I see that my time is about to expire.
May I ask a question, Chief Judge?
Yes.
Starting with the question of the request for consent, and you're not asking for overruling precedent on that, but the request for consent in many cases is going to produce in itself a response that's potentially incriminating. That is, if the issue is whether someone owns a cell phone, today cell phones are ubiquitous, maybe not as important, but not everybody has one. If you ask someone if you can search their car, one of the issues in the case involves ownership or possession of a car, the mere response, yes, you may search, even without the identification, that's potentially incriminating there. So what is the principle that's used for drawing a line without revisiting that underlying question of whether the request for consent itself is almost always at least potentially incriminating at the outset of an investigation?
Your Honor, I think if I understand your question correctly, what is used there is the exclusionary rule. And at that point then, if you have just a simple request to search your car, I think what could potentially come out from that is that the consent, there's two parts of that question. There's the request for consent, and then there's the admission that it's your car. And I think with that, I think the consent to search is still fine, but any admissions that talk about the proprietary ownership of that car are now excluded. Now, the difference there.
So if the law enforcement comes to the individual and says, we've got registration information on a particular car, it's registered to you, you consent to us searching that, that's not incriminating. But if they don't have that information, then any request for consent without the prior identification is incriminating.
Your Honor, I would say that is correct, and that's from ROA.
And so in this case, where are we on the cell phone?
There was no evidence produced by the government that indicated the cell phone in his possession belonged to him, period.
So Chief Judge has permitted me to ask some questions. I just want to make sure I understand the boundaries of your question, of your argument. Let's say a different case. The accused starts answering questions, and they specifically, the OSI agent specifically asks him, is that your phone? Yes. Have you had custody and control of that over the last year? Yes. Anybody else had access to that? No. All those types of questions. Then the accused invokes, and they say, okay, just one more question. Do we have consent to search your phone, and would you be willing to give us your passcode to do so?
So I think, if I'm understanding your question, is that the government has now elicited incriminating responses, and there's been a waiver, there's been a valid waiver, so they've elicited incriminating responses. Can they then rely on those to establish ownership? And I think the answer to that would be yes.
But my question is a little different. Is it then, you keep on referring to proprietary interests and so forth, that's all been established prior to the invocation. And the question simply is, okay, you've just invoked, we're seeking authorization to consent to search and your passcode. You're saying that that would still be impermissible.
I would say the request for consent is fine. The request for passcode is still problematic. Because then that proves that, I mean, you're relying on his truth-telling, and that actually goes back to Hubbell. So everything that he had talked about and that he had established himself, the ultimate proof of that he's telling the truth, is he's using the contents of his mind to confirm a fact that could be used against him in court. And that would be incriminating. And under Hubbell, I think that's where the decision would lie. Your Honor, pending further questions, I'll...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Suki, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Tyler Musselman, and with me is Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, and together we represent the United States in this proceeding. The analysis in this case begins and ends with consent. OSI's request for appellant's passcode did not run afoul of Edwards or the Fifth Amendment protections, as it was part and parcel of voluntary consent. It did nothing more than facilitate the carrying out of appellant's...
All right, there's a white bear sitting in the road, and its name is Mitchell. How do you get around it?
Well, I think, first of all, just, and this may be pointing out the obvious, but Mitchell wasn't a consent case, this is. And so there's obviously the direct quote in Mitchell that you yourself wrote, Chief Judge, about how request for a passcode is not a mere request for consent. However, in Mitchell, that request for a passcode came on the tail end of a search authorization, where here we have consent. And I'll explain why that matters. Here the passcode is merely part and parcel of the consent because it did not give the government anything.
Well, here we have an interrogation that came to a halt when he invoked and then started up again and got certainly into third gear, if not overdrive, after he'd invoked. So where's that leave?
Well, Your Honor, he invokes, and then there was, they told him about the administrative processes they were going to have
to
do.
Right, and then they went way off the administrative processes and started poking around looking for evidence.
Well, first thing they did was request for consent. So that occurred, and if you're referring to the witness question that OSI asked, that was obviously out of bounds. The request for consent came before that, the passcode request came after that. So what you have is, we know from the case law that a request for consent is not implicated by Edwards because it's neither testimonial
more.
Nor incriminating. Excuse me, Your Honor?
Sorry. Without more. Go ahead.
Yes, without more. And my point here is that the passcode is part and parcel. And I think Judge Ryan was sort of asking these questions about, do we have to then kick the door down, those sort of questions. Because what we have here is, through the consent, what he has implicitly acknowledged is ownership, dominion, and control over the phone. I think Judge Efron was sort of getting to those points in his question. So if he's already done that through consent, through something he can do under Edwards and the Fifth Amendment, the passcode establishing ownership, control, and access is superfluous. It's part and parcel of the request.
Well, if it's superfluous, why did they want to know it?
Well, that's the part of the access. And I would say that consent itself is granting access.
What do you mean that's part of the access? Because I've been wondering what the Chief Judge just asked. Why were they asking that information? They had the phone in front of them.
They needed that passcode to get into the phone.
No, but when they were asking the make and model and so forth.
Oh, that was administrative questions relating to the consent form. In other words,
they used it to put on the consent form? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it was describing the thing that he was consenting to search.
That's right, for his knowing and voluntary consent. For instance, it hasn't been brought up in any of the briefs, but you had the administrative questions that were asked when he was initially in the room to include his address. So, for example, if they were to use that response to then write the address on the consent form, I don't see how that implicates Edwards' Fifth Amendment. My point here is that understanding Mitchell was a search authorization case, where the person was against providing the phone. Here we have consent, and the passcode in this case doesn't establish anything more than the consent already did. It's folded up underneath of it. The ownership, the dominion, the control, all of that was established through the consent, which in Morris, this court held implicit within an individual's consent to search is acknowledgement of ownership, or at very least, dominion and control over the property to be searched. In other words, the consent established that, and the passcode did nothing more than facilitate that access. That's why I started out with this begins and ends with consent. Because to me, the issue is just folded under consent, and I think that's what makes this different from Mitchell.
Can we go back to the appellate defense counsel's point that, well, once I consent and give you my phone, you got to get in it however which way you can figure out how to get in it. I think that's, if I understood him, he can clear me up on rebuttal, but I thought that's what I understood his position to be. Let's assume that it is for the moment. That once you ask me, will you consent to the search of your phone? And I say yes, and I give you the phone. What's wrong with making the government find their own way to get into the phone? I'm not suggesting there isn't a problem with it. I'm just wondering what your response to that very narrow, narrow question.
Well, I have two ways to answer that. One is, I think, obviously the government could. I think that if you consent to a search of your home, they could walk up and back.
Well, your home, I'm specifically talking about phones, because it's not so obvious to me that you can always get into a phone. The government can always get into a phone, is it?
Right, I agree. And actually, that brings up an interesting point here. In this case, the appellant testified during motions, and he testified that he gave consent because they didn't think he was going to find any evidence on his phone. But more importantly, your question,
unfortunately,
Judge,
he was wrong.
Right, well, you're right, yeah. But I think more important for your question is that he testified about him, he knew about the security features on his own phone.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he knew there was a passcode. He knew that if it was incorrectly put in 10 times, it would erase the phone. So you have somebody with that knowledge giving consent. It seems to me that they would anticipate that someone would need the passcode of their phone. And I don't talk about that in hypothetical terms because it was established during the appellant's own motion testimony. So I think on one hand, if there's no way for the government to get into the phone, then we can't get into the phone. But I think that if somebody voluntarily hands over their phone to be searched with the understanding that they have security features on their phone that will prevent somebody from accessing it.
What if he thinks the government has all the powers in the world and the scientific knowledge to get in the phone?
Well, I think that's a potential. But I think really what we're talking about here is it's just another layer of access, but he's already granted access.
Right, but what if he knows all of the things you just suggested, that the government could get in my phone if they want to. Yes, I know that I have a passcode and I can restrict access. But yes, government, you can search my phone. Is he, by definition, conceding that he is allowing you to get in the phone with his passcode? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I think that's the only logical conclusion. Why?
No, I mean, it's logical, but I mean, is that what you're suggesting?
I think so, Your Honor, because why would someone grant consent if they ultimately know you can't search it?
He's the government.
Well, I mean, we can come up with all kinds of hypotheticals.
Yeah, I can conceive of a situation in which you could say, yeah, you can search my phone. Go dig it out.
Yeah, what about that? I mean, he gives the phone and then, like, you know.
Right. Well,
I don't think the one implies the other.
Well, I think we don't have to imply it in this case because we know that's not the case. He testified during motions hearing about why he consented to his phone. He was willing to have them look through it because he didn't think there was any evidence on it. On his part. But I think, granted, this isn't a case where he says because there was exculpatory information on there, but obviously the absence of any evidence would have helped this case. So we can talk about, the mischievous, finger-touching maybe on another OSI video, but we don't have that here. We know because of the motions hearing. And all of this just goes back to my point that in this case specifically, the passcode was merely facilitating the consent. It was part and parcel, if you were, or folded within it. And
this issue ultimately goes to the opportunity to consult with counsel. Isn't that at the heart of this issue in terms of whether you will or will not have the opportunity to consult with counsel as to how you respond?
Well,
and the underlying case law is saying, no, you're not going to have, you're not guaranteed the warning and the opportunity to consult with counsel before you consent to the search.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the great explanation of that is Bustamante, the Supreme Court's opinion there, where they're comparing Fifth Amendment rights with Fourth Amendment, and they say that for consent to search, you don't have to be warned, and there aren't the same interests at play.
Right. And then the issue arises beyond the consent in the situation where the government already has the knowledge that the object to be searched, they know what it is and they know that it's yours. When there's the risk that the responses could be incriminating, why isn't that a good place to draw the line? And simply say, as opposed to saying, well, we're going to allow the inquiry as to where it is, and we're going to allow the inquiry as to what your password is, because that's necessary to effectuate the consent. I understand that. But why shouldn't someone have the opportunity to consult with a lawyer at that point so that the lawyer can provide advice as to whether, in giving that answer, you're not simply facilitating the consent, you may be giving up incriminating information as well. The example being one where the question is, where's your car that you've consented to search?
And I think going back, and let me answer it this way, I think in this case we don't have like a location or anything like that. It's strictly the passcode, and so we're strictly talking about access. I think in those, and so to me, this case really just goes back to, we know under this court's precedent and the Federal Circuit precedent that a consent to search doesn't implicate the Fifth Amendment because it's neither incriminating nor testimonial. And so to me, since it's folded under there, that answers the Edwards and Fifth Amendment question for the passcode. Now, you're talking about some other instances.
No, I'm actually asking about the passcode, that is. If the question is, do you have consent? Do you give consent to search? And the person says yes. And then the next question is, what is your passcode? The question of whether that inquiry is or is not incriminating can only be determined by understanding the scope of the investigation and where things stand at that point. So why isn't that something that you'd want to have the advice of a lawyer on before responding? I think your answer that you've given is that in this case, looking in retrospect, your view, it wasn't incriminating. But it might be in another case. That passcode might be incriminating in another case.
Well,
is that your position, or is your position that once you've consented to search, that it's okay to ask for access to so that you can actually search?
Yes, and I think... Yes, Your Honor. It's, as Judge Ryan puts it, it's about access, and I think that's what this case is about. But to get back to your answer, Your Honor, to me, I don't think that we go on this separate analysis of the what is your passcode, because it's folded under the access portion of the consent. In other words, since we know that consent in and of itself is not...
wait a minute. Are you saying that once you consent, you're compelled, as a rule of law, to cough up the code?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
Well, that seemed to be what you were suggesting.
No,
what
no,
are
no.
you saying?
What I'm saying is that since, under the case law, a request for consent to search after invocation doesn't implicate Edwards, because it's neither testimonial nor incriminating, a question like, what is your passcode, which merely facilitates that consent, is covered under that, I guess, authorization of,
no, I
of
understand
Edwards
your,
and Fifth Amendment.
I understand your answer there.
I don't
there.
Think Mitchell agrees with that, but go ahead.
Yeah. And Your Honor, so to get into the second portion of your point, if we were to assume that the Fifth Amendment and Edwards apply to what is your passcode, is that ultimately your question?
Yeah, my question is, we may know, do we take the position that you've taken, which is that the request for the password is simply facilitating the consent, and irrespective of whether the request for the password may produce incriminating information. That is, there may be a case in which the password itself has independent value in the case as substantive evidence. You may not know that at the beginning. The question is, do you have the opportunity at that point to consult with a lawyer and at that point before you cough up the password so that a lawyer can make assist you in that determination as to whether or not the password itself is potentially giving incriminating information in this case.
Well, and I think that, to answer your question, I think that goes back to my point about this is just access. I guess there could be a circumstance where maybe your password is an admission that you're a pedophile. It would seem to me that in and of itself, the password contains incriminating evidence in and of itself. To me, that goes beyond access.
Is there anything in this case that suggests that it was like Hutchins, where it was really a pretext to try and get other information?
No, Your Honor. It was.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. There was nothing the investigators had that was reasonably likely to anticipate that his response for a passcode would be incriminating. And it wasn't. It was 0407. So, to answer your question that way, I think there are circumstances where if you ask for consent, if you begin to ask questions that elicit information that go well beyond what you've already determined or what's already implicit in consent, that you're going to run into an Edwards and Fifth Amendment.
Well, are you saying, as an example, that the password is itself obscene or something like that?
Potentially. I think, I
didn't quite know what you're getting at.
I think if you say...
You said that the password reveals that you're a pedophile. Okay. The password is itself an obscene term in use among pedophiles? Something like that?
Well, just something of that nature. I think another example would be, can we search your farm, specifically the portion where you buried the body? Okay, where is that section of your land? Right? I mean, it's an extreme hypothetical.
Or the example of the car. The police don't know that you have a car.
Right.
So they ask, and then the question of the key, and then the key may be have itself some information attached to it, and he would not know that he had the right to refuse the key. So the question there is, if we follow what you've suggested here, how does this play out at trial? And that is it the defense, assuming that the defense is then objecting to the evidence of the search, is it the defense's burden to show that the government was doing something more than the administrative question of access at that point? How does this play out in terms of determining whether there was or was not a violation by asking the question of access?
I think it's the same way. I mean, ultimately, it's that's a determination to be made by the military judge using the principles that we've been given through the consent framework as well as the Fifth Amendment. Ultimately, like I said, you're talking about other examples like the location of a car and stuff like that. That just goes back to my point where in this case, we know there was nothing beyond what was already given through consent.
So following up on that, in this, would you look at this case and saying it was the burden of the defense at trial to say why this was something more than facilitating consent?
No, I think it just goes back to the burdens that are in the MREs regarding whether it was an unreasonable search or a search conducted without lawful authorization. I would like to point a couple things out. One thing that didn't make it in the JA to address about possession of this phone, and I apologize, but the military judge made a ruling on a motion in limine regarding foundation for the text messages. And in the ruling, he found that the agent took the phone from the accused's possession. Of course, AFCA in their ruling found that at no point was possession ever at issue. So here we have a cell phone that we know is possessed by appellant. You don't see the agent ever ask where it is. He goes, writes, and gets it and brings it back. That was never at issue. He possessed a cell phone. He had dominion control over it. All that was satisfied, and we know, especially when he says, yes, you can consent to my cell phone.
Was there any, for lack of a better word, badgering to get the password? Or did they just say, can we have your password?
Yeah, I think they just came in and said, can we have your passcode? I think ultimately they said, so we don't mess your phone up, which once again the military judge identified that since the appellant testified in motions hearing that he knew that if you typed your passcode in 10 times it would wipe your phone, was a reasonable suggestion. But I think ultimately you can just look at the appellant's testimony on the issue as well as the interview video to determine that this was not a result of badgering. Ultimately, it's the government's primary position that this is a consent case and is utterly distinguishable, therefore, from Mitchell, given that this really just amounts to access. I see I have 45 seconds left. I would like to put one thing to the court, which is in Mitchell, this court analyzed the issue stating that only Edwards only applies to whether or not there was an interrogation. I think that this may conflict with Pennsylvania v. Muniz, or Muniz, excuse me, M-U-N-I-Z, the Supreme Court's precedent in that case. In that case, Judge Scalia looked at an unwarned questions during, I think, a DUI arrest and hung his hat on the testimonial aspects of those answers. This case implicates both the testimonial and compulsion components of the privilege. Any verbal statements were both testimonial in nature and elicited during custodial interrogation should have been suppressed. And he's talking about this in the context of an unwarned Miranda statement. I think it's, and I see I'm over time, if I could briefly conclude this thought unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
And just to conclude, I think that that case demonstrates that even after Edwards, a statement has to be testimonial, compelled, and interrogating to be suppressed under Miranda and Edwards. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to start off with what my learned colleague talked about. There's no question as to possession. And again, I would just like to remind this court that possession is different than ownership. And I would point to the record here that indicates that OSI did not know he owned the phone. That's why they asked those questions. What is the make and model of your phone?
Counsel, they were filling out a form, right?
They went beyond
filling
a form, Your Honor.
Information is on the form, and that's what the military judge found. And the burden, we look at the facts in the light most favorable to the party that prevailed below, which wasn't you.
That is correct, Your Honor. But again, I would just remind this court that they did not have that information. If they had that information ahead of time, they would have put that form in there. They wouldn't have asked those questions of him. So possession is different than ownership. And I think that's the main point here. And I would like to also say that what you said, Judge Efron, was that could the stuff have been used against him? Yeah, it not only could have been, it was used against him. On the record, all of those, my learned colleague would like to call administrative booking type questions, those were admissions that were used against him to prove his guilt. And that is where the issue lies.
Counsel, if we were to hold, and not asking you to concede this, that a question directed solely at access to facilitate the consent is permissible, what went beyond that in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think so. That's where the application of, I think, 305C2 comes into play. Because when you actually get the passcode itself, and that helps establish knowledge, control, ownership, exclusivity, so that in and of itself is interrogation, 305C2 comes into play because any derivative evidence from that now cannot come in as evidence. And that's where it actually, that should have been the rule here, is that but for giving the passcode, you wouldn't have got that evidence. That's derivative of that, and that should have been suppressed.
So based on that, I just, again, want to understand the boundaries of your argument. Let's say in a hypothetical, the accused invokes right to counsel. They say, do we have the consent to search your phone? Everything's fine.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Instead of then asking for the passcode, they hand the phone over to him, kind of tap the screen, kind of a universal indication, well, okay, we can't get access to this unless you give us the passcode. So they don't say a word. They simply hand the phone back over to him. He enters the passcode. Is the information then, evidence then admissible?
No, Your Honor. That would fall under Rhode Island v. Innis. That would be something that the investigator should know is reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response.
And so it's because of them getting into the mind of the person at that point?
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think that a distinction can be made, for example, of the fingerprint. A lot of the phones have fingerprints on them right now. I don't think that would get into the mind of the accused. That wouldn't call for any sort of communicated value of it. That's a physical act.
So the mere handing back to an accused of his own phone is likely to cause him to incriminate himself.
Your Honor, I think it depends on the circumstances. I think the way that you described it, if I understood your question correctly, was they kind of give it to him and indicating that they can't get into it. Non-verbally. I think that would be then something that they should know would be reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Again,
the incriminating response is what? What's the incriminating response?
In this particular case, Your Honor, again, it would be the response that indicates implicitly that he owns the phone, he controls it, he has knowledge of its working, and that there's potential exclusivity to it because it's passcode protected. So the government, and Your Honor, I apologize. I see my time is almost up. Can I finish answering the question?
Yes.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor. So what I was saying was that with the exclusivity aspect of it, that is evidence that the government can certainly go into and say, hey, listen, as opposed to a public computer in a library somewhere that anyone can have access to, this is a cell phone that's password protected. It's limited to a certain amount of people that can get access to
it.
Well,
let's say it's not password protected, but you say, can I search your phone? You say yes, gives him the phone. Like, all those things are implicated.
I think
all those same things are implicated. My old phone wasn't password protected, right? And I liked it that way because now I always have to type things in every 5 seconds, it seems. Right? So if somebody asked for my phone, right, they would have had my phone, right?
And, Your Honor, I think that's fine. And I think that's fine because there's, again, two parts to that question. There is, do I have consent, and do I have consent to search your phone? The consent to search.
I have consent to search your phone. I give them the phone. They search my phone, and it shows that it was my phone, right? Mm-hmm. I give them the phone, that I have dominion, I have access, I have exclusivity. And that somehow changes if I type in my password?
Yes, because it confirms it. Yes, Your Honor. Because at that point in time, when you give someone the phone, unless you're
what
indicating that it's your ownership.
What if my phone is engraved and it says Judge Margaret A. Ryan with my Social Security number?
I think that is fantastic circumstantial evidence, but what Rhode Island v. Innis talked about is that the self-incrimination privilege does not distinguish between degrees of incrimination. And so what you're talking about there is absolutely strong circumstantial evidence, but it's not that nail in the defense's coffin.
Counsel, if I could, may I follow up the question that I asked before just to tie it down? Not asking you to concede that a opportunity for access question would be permissible. But if we were to hold that consent followed by access to facilitate the consent is permissible, what in this case was revealed beyond that? That is, in terms of an subsequent interrogation. What beyond the information that you would get from facilitating access is at issue here?
It was all of the contents of the phone, Your Honor. It was everything that the passcode revealed. The passcode was the direct evidence to the, or direct access to the only evidence that was used to convict Airman Robinson.
And I understand your argument on that. But my question is, if we were to hold that if you can consent, your consent includes consent to access, then what is beyond that in this case?
So, Your Honor, and I apologize. I'm going to see if I can understand the question here.
I may not be articulating.
No, it's probably my fault. I think, again, what the case should turn on is when you provide consent, you are, to a certain degree, providing consent to access. You're saying you can go ahead and do this. The problem with this is this is communicative in nature. This is the communication aspect versus the consent itself. And so the consent itself is absolutely providing access to certain evidence. But the government has to go beyond that to actually get there if it's passcode protected or there's some other mechanism that's in place that requires someone to use the contents of their mind to access that information. That will go beyond the scope of the mere consent to search.
I understand your position. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. Court stands in recess pending further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands in recess until further order of the court.